Hello and welcome to Anthropology on Air, a podcast brought to you by the Social Anthropology Department at the University of Bergen in Norway. Each season, we bring you conversations with inspiring thinkers who are either based at our department or who have come to share their research with us. In this very first episode, we speak with Craig Hetherington about his project on ghost rivers in Montreal, Canada. Craig is Associate Professor of Sociology and Anthropology at Concordia University, where he specializes in environment, infrastructure, and the bureaucratic state. He is the author of the multi-award-winning 2020 book, The Government of Beans, based on his long-term fieldwork on soybeans in Paraguay, as well as Guerrilla Auditors, an ethnography of land struggles in Paraguay. As you'll hear, Craig's current work continues to engage with the more than human world, this time with rivers, even ones that sometimes cannot be seen anymore. Craig directs the Concordia Ethnography Lab, where he runs a collaborative project called Emergent Waters, which aims to understand Montreal's changing relationship with water as a defining feature of its environment and infrastructure. In this conversation, Craig and I begin by discussing his current work and the possibilities and limitations of thinking of rivers and other non-humans as kin or persons. We also talk about the methodological and pedagogical approach Craig calls composite ethnography, as well as STS, science and technology studies, and how the particular qualities of water make it a different kind of ethnographic object compared to land. This episode was recorded in early December 2022 when Craig was in Bergen to present at the Bergen Social Anthropology Seminars series. We hope you enjoy the conversation. So it is my pleasure to welcome Craig Hetherington to the studio, all the way from Montreal in Canada. And Craig, you're here to talk to us today about ghost rivers in the Anthropocene. Please, can you explain the background to this project and what you mean by ghost rivers?
Yeah, so this project is part of a larger project that I've been carrying out with a large group of students for many years on water in Montreal. And each year we take on a different kind of aspect of how people are relating to water in the city. It can be climate change related or not quite, but it always sort of ends up being that way because water just behaves differently as the climate changes. And one of those projects was this river that we discovered that we just didn't know about before, that had been buried many, many years ago in the city, as rivers tend to be as things industrialize and as sewage becomes a problem. But what we were really interested in this river for was realizing a lot of other people were also curious about it, and it ended up having this kind of odd presence in the city where people followed it or tried to dig up information about it or imagined what it would be like to bring it back to life, and even held a funeral for it in one particular instance. And so what we wanted to do was, on the one hand, get to know the river a little bit better, but also try to think of it in relation to a lot of other literature about the Anthropocene that talks about these ghosts and these past presences that kind of come into people's existence and people's understanding of ecology around them. So that's our ghost river. And we were able to then relate it not only to a lot of these kind of ghost stories that attend to other entities, but also to river stories that happen in most cities, have some kind of a river story in their past that reemerges in one way or another as people rethink urban ecology.
Mm. And I'm hearing these words like hauntings and ghosts and funerals. In many ways, part of living in the Anthropocene is becoming familiar with these kinds of loss and even making kin with different manifestations of loss, as I think you have suggested. And the funeral held for the river reminded me of this retreating glacier in Iceland called the Ok Glacier, which you're probably familiar with. And they created a funeral plaque and held a vigil for this glacier, which had retreated so much that it was no longer a glacier. Mm-hmm. So how do these concepts around, you know, in the lexicon of loss, how do these concepts figure in your work, and what can you say about how the notion of kin is being challenged or expanded in the Anthropocene.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm really curious. Certainly the Icelandic glacier example was one that was very much present as we sort of thought about this, and also this really expanding literature on kin that I find very interesting, but also at times a little bit limiting. So one of the things that I'm still thinking with in this project is, okay, so we throw a funeral for a river, or a bunch of people feel moved to throw a funeral for a river. In a way, you can think of that as a kinning move, as a way of saying, of trying to build a relation with something that you that then becomes something like family. And yet, it's a river, and that's a very different thing. And there's a certain irony to that, which all the participants are aware of, right? Mm. And so the question then is, how far does thinking of this as kin get us, and how far does thinking about these as new sorts of ways of relating to landscapes also help? And I guess the kind of corollary to that is there's a lot of talk about sort of personhood in nature as a way of thinking about how to protect, including rivers, but also other entities. And so that can be really helpful juridically. It can be really helpful for thinking about how we relate to these sorts of things. But at the same time, a river is not the same as a person, and it's not the same as a, say, species of bird that someone wants to protect, right? And so thinking about the specificity beyond these analogies to personhood or kin is kind of where I want to take this work.
Mm. Could you maybe say a bit more about that? Like, what direction you see it could go in beyond kin?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I think I think rivers are very specific sorts of things, and they're not even, I mean, even calling a certain phenomenon a river is itself a historically emplaced kind of a thing. And imagining sort of why we think of a particular piece of landscape with water running through it as a river and not as a wetland, or not as a couple of embankments that happen to have something else going on with them. You know, when is a river just a ditch that happens to be full of water? All of those are questions that are very specific to how we think about water in a particular place. And maybe this is just the anthropologist in me, but I really don't want to lose that kind of specificity of what those material relations are all about. And I would even say, so this is part of the thing about personhood, you know, there are places in the world where that language of personhood works really well, or certain kinds of peoples for whom that's meaningful. And I don't think we necessarily need to go the next step of saying, well, therefore, all rivers ought to be treated as people, and we should sort of think about it that way, right? That there are other ways of relating that are at least equally valid and maybe are more appropriate to other kinds of situations.
Mm. So I think something, if I'm correct, that developed out of your work on rivers is this notion of composite ethnography. What was that responding to?
So composite ethnography, which I've been talking about a lot lately and I'm still trying to get a grapple on, is really sort of a methodological approach that I've been working with this group of students at the Concordia Ethnography Lab. And it comes from sort of two things that we tried to bring together. On the one hand, a lot of us are coming from an ethnographic tradition in science and technology studies that's really interested in the multiple existences of objects. So thinking about what objects multiple are like and how you apprehend them ethnographically. One way to think about that is, well, what you do is, instead of just thinking about a thing as a thing, you're sort of composing it out of all these elements that sort of hang together, but sort of don't hang together at the same time. So I'm really interested in that quality of knowledge and that quality of object in the world. Rivers are very good for that sort of thing. So are soybeans, which is something that I studied a lot, right? if you think about the various ways you can come into that, that's sort of a composite. But on the other hand, I also was trying really hard to figure out ways to do work with students that could be, and not just students, but they're the ones who've mainly wanted to work with me so far, that could be genuinely collaborative, where you have sort of a horizontal approach to a project rather than something that's very theoretically driven by a single person. You kind of open up a question and let people go at it from different angles and then try to compose what you're doing afterwards. And so that's sort of an oblique way of getting at ethnography, but I find it really, really rich because you get these great dialogues around it and it leaves a lot of room for surprise. You just have to be willing for the result to be that kind of indeterminate composite multiple kind of thing that a lot of these projects have ended up producing, which I really enjoy writing with. So not only the water project, but also this soybeans project that I did before ended up being a lot of kind of allowing things to explode in the ethnography into like multiple fragments all over the place, and then trying to harness them into something that you can present as a book or as some other sort of representation of these things without losing that sort of grainy quality of the composite that it came with.
Would you mind going into a bit more detail in one or both of those examples about what it looks like in practice and how you teach that to students, maybe?
Sure. So, maybe it's easiest with the water project because that was more intentional. So I had done this before in Paraguay with this soybean project, and it was kind of, we fell into this method of doing things. And then I tried in the project in Montreal to kind of recreate that more intentionally. And what that really meant was getting a whole bunch of people together and saying, we're going to study water in Montreal. We're not going to say much more about what we think that even means or even what we think water is. And the only parameters are you have to work in groups and you have to be open to whatever people are going to say along the way and then just kind of see where that takes you. It's an incredibly simple, low bar sort of a thing, but I have found that opening the door in that way of just saying, you know, anyone can come in, anyone can play this game, and we're going to kind of see where it goes, has just been, it's opened up a whole new way of working for me, which I really, really enjoy. Now what that means is, the project takes quite a while, and we have these little groups of students, sometimes with a faculty member, who are kind of working on one little object. And sometimes it fizzles out and they have a sort of a weird idea and it doesn't work. And then other times, like the Ghost River or like something we did on urban glaciers that come from snow removal, or a film that was made about an old industrial canal. There are all these kinds of things that pop out of the composite mix that we end up then kind of running with. But we're still in the middle of it. So we have these little things still on the way, but what that looks like as one big statement one can make about urban water, just start at the beginning of figuring that part out. So the recomposing part of it is not quite there yet.
It sounds like a really good way of bringing in sort of non-academic sources as well, getting away from theory and bringing the public in or different kinds of actors.
Yeah. So I would say, I have two things to say about that. On the one hand, I'm a person who loves theory. I teach the theory class, the core theory class in our department, and I'm really inspired by that kind of thinking. But I do find that when you sit down to do something ethnographically, too much kind of theoretical preconception of what you're doing can be quite limiting. It can also be anxiety producing. And it can be very, I don't know what your experience of this as grad students is yet, but I find in grad school, it can sometimes be the biggest source of blockage in figuring out a project. So having sort of seen lots of students go through that and having gone through that myself as a student at one point, the idea here was really just like, okay, theory is theory. We're going to read it. We're going to have fun with it. But we're gonna try to let objects lead us. So again, getting back to the Ghost River, this was great because once we decided, which took a while, that there was this thing that was a Ghost River, then we could kind of just say, well, okay, what does the Ghost River want us to do in this project, right? And that's not a theoretical question, although it has all kinds of theoretical implications. It sort of allows something else to lead you methodologically. And then, of course, you have to run off to the side and go, okay, well, who's theorizing ghosts, and does any of that fit with what we're doing? Or who's theorizing infrastructure, or who's talking about water, or whatever it is? And then kind of rebuild from there. But really, this kind of agnosticism about theory to begin with is just part of the way that we approach that. That definitely, as you said in sort of the second part of your question, or maybe it was the first, is that it's very inviting, right? So whether you end up succeeding in bringing non-academics into the project or not, you can bring lots of different kinds of academics into the project, and lots of people who feel different sorts of attachments to different theory or to different ways of doing their discipline and different in these ways. And we've, you know, one of the things that was great about this, for example, was when COVID hit in Montreal, and we were in, you know, really deep isolation, and that was a horrible experience if you were a grad student who was already dealing with the anxiety of grad school and then had to deal with everything else on top of it. In some ways, doing a project like this was just kind of a way to relax into doing anthropology or doing ethnography, and not feel like the stakes were too high necessarily, but then nonetheless see something really cool come out of it as we kept going.
Great. And just one more question on composite ethnography. Do you see it as being in some ways a natural partner to studying the more than human in anthropology, or do you see any connection there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I do think so. I think for me, it's come out of an interest in materiality in general. And so I'm struggling to write a paper right now about composite ethnography in which I don't lean too heavily on the sort of STS theory that informs it for me. Precisely because I want to keep it as open as possible. And yet I do find that's a really good way into it. So I haven't quite decided how much I think these things are wedded together. I think there are advantages to this method that don't need to go through that route. And yet in that route, there's all kinds of really, really great synergies. So for me, it was really the Waterways Project came from an interest in infrastructure, you know, not necessarily a multi-species or a more than human entities, although those more than humans have continually populated the infrastructure we were looking at. When I did it with the soybean project in Paraguay, it was very much a how can I think of what a soybean is ethnographically. And so it was a multi-species kind of a project from the beginning, although that's not necessarily where it ended up. And this was a way of doing that, was again gathering people together and saying, I don't know what we're looking at, everybody try some different ideas, and then let's see what comes of it.
Thank you. And so to turn to those soybeans, your book with Duke University Press, The Government of Beans, came out in 2020 and was based on this long-term research in Paraguay that you've done. Have you found that there's a difference between studying watery phenomena like rivers compared with terrestrial, such as soybeans?
I mean, absolutely. I think my impulse in that question is to say, I'd want to make it even more fine-grained, right? There's a difference. No matter what material phenomenon you're looking at, there's going to be a set of different ways that you articulate it into other things. Soybeans, in fact, before I was doing a soybean project, I was really doing a land and law project. That's what my dissertation was about in my first book. And so thinking about land as a particular set of relations was really important, and realizing after a while that kind of the way land is governed has this deep colonial history, no matter where you are, that doesn't need to be the way it is. And yet we definitely apprehend land in terms of kind of ownership and the ability to divide it up in these different ways. So that's land. And then you get to water, and one of the contrasts, I mean, water is amazing because it just kind of moves, and you can say, oh, look, there's a river, but then there's all the question of like, what's the relationship between the water and the river? And there's this sort of great multiplicity always with water, and it's so lively and it moves around. So that's fun. But you also realize there's this sort of great contrast in Western legal traditions between how you deal with land and how you deal with water. And that has all kinds of consequences for then how we theorize what those things are and how people behave around them and what do you think they can do. So the water project that I was not expecting this to happen necessarily, but it's ended up being also, parts of it have ended up being also about property, and how different property forms end up when you're talking about water or even just water adjacent land. Things just look different and they behave differently, and your relationship to the state and to other kind of authority, but also to the ability to produce knowledge, is all kind of affected by that. So I haven't worked this all out yet, but something about those colonial histories of the legal difference between land and water have ended up being really, really good to think with. Yeah.
Could you perhaps sketch out those differences for people that maybe aren't so familiar with legal mechanisms? Like, how are these things framed in Western countries?
Yeah, so, I mean, just at a very basic level, you can't really own rivers usually, right? And you can't own the ocean. And there are exceptions to that, right? So there are rivers that go through private property that are sort of owned, and yet you'll find all of these carve-outs in most legal traditions where if you have a river running through your property, there other people have rights of access and you're not allowed to change things, right? And so there's this kind of there's a special place that's left for rivers. And then seeing how and coastlines, right? And then seeing how people interact with them as a result of that. For example, if you have water going through your land, and let's say you're a farmer, you have a river going through your land. Initially, that's going to be great. That's probably why the farm is there to begin with, because you've got water and you've got access to water. But then the water has sort of a life of its own, and it wants to it changes its course a little bit, and it chews away at your fields and all these things. And so people start to canalize it, right? And then you have this, you know, laws about how much you can alter these rivers that are a source of constant contention. But in most places, right, you'll find, or in most of Europe, for example, you'll find rivers over time have slowly been turned into, you know, canals that go through agricultural territory. And in part, that's really about reclaiming land. It's not about the river itself, but then it changes the river. And in changing the river, it also changes the land. And so all this to say, I guess I've gone down a little bit of a rabbit hole, but all this to say that this kind of property forms and the difficulty of dealing with the liveliness of water, but also the sort of not ownability of water has had ecological repercussions in all of these places. Straight rivers are not nearly as good ecologically for most living things as meandering rivers, for example. Another example I can give from the Montreal case is that before the arrival of Europeans, the rivers in and around Montreal are extremely important, massive, massive rivers. So they were ways for people to get around. Obviously, when the French arrive, they are obsessed with the land in and around the rivers. And so thinking about how some people can treat those rivers as entities in and of themselves that they have a relationship with, and how the colonizers came and saw, well, what is it here that we can own? What can we control as spots of land? And then the rivers end up being these sorts of add-ons around them, very important add-ons, but they're different from how you're thinking about controlling territory. So again, I think there's a story to be told there in how the colonization of North America affects that relationship between land and water, and probably has a massive effect on how people are imagining territory and treaties and the ceding or not of land as well.
And in the same book, The Government of Beans, I was really struck by how you frame the soybean as a character of the Anthropocene. Can you please tell us about why you chose to frame it that way and whether you see any other kinds of characters now in your work now?
Yeah. So I think partly, and I remember really clearly how that happened in that book, and partly it was I just decided on it as a narrative convention, and so I wanted to find a way to get people into the story that I was telling, which was a more than human story, but I didn't necessarily want to spend a lot of time kind of arguing that non-humans have agency and these sorts of things that people get really hung up on, right? And so instead of saying that, I just want to say, listen, these beans are really important in people's lives, if you're just interested in the people, but they're really important in the whole way that South America is being transformed right now. But if you actually try to sit down and say, you know, what is it about soybeans? Why do they do what they're doing? And I haven't gotten into it, but they really are this just massive ecological transformation of the southern part of South America for the production of one species of soybean that's then being fed to vegetable-eating animals all over the world that can then be eaten as meat. So what is it about these soybeans? Why do they cause deforestation? Why do they cause ethnic tension in places like where I was? Why do they sort of reconfigure the whole way the farming economy happens? And why are some people in love with them? We'll describe it that way. And some people are terrified of them. So thinking about them as a character and saying you don't have to take on a whole new set of ontological propositions to read it this way, but let's just say it this way and tell the story that way. And I find that that sort of fits with the approach I've been talking about, right? This idea that we can tell stories about ecological and social transformations that are open theoretically, but that and that you can engage with at different sorts of levels without kind of feeling like there's a theoretical price of entry. Characters was a useful way of thinking about that, and I've since found it very useful for other things. So the Ghost River is totally a character in the way that I think about the transformation of Montreal over time. Yeah.
Thank you. So for our final question in this podcast, we like to ask if you have any recommendations for a researcher, a book, or an article that has inspired you or in any way influenced your work that you would suggest other people read also.
Yeah, so I mean, there's just so many. I was trying to think about this before and trying to think what I could say. But maybe since the conversation has gone in this, in the direction it has, the book that opened me up methodologically to thinking about these things is already fairly old, but is John Law's After Method, I think it's called. Mess in the Social Sciences from 2004. If you've been sort of thinking about actor network theory and not figuring out how it sort of fits in your overall view of the world, that book for me is the most sort of open and lovely and easy to get way into it, and I always go back to it. So I'll put that one out there.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Craig, and I hope you enjoy your time in Bergen as well.
I'm Ariane, thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to Anthropology on Air, a project of the Social Anthropology Department at the University of Bergen. The music in the podcast was made by Victor Lange, and the episode was produced by Sadie Hale and Sissel Marie Henriksen. If you like what you've heard, why not subscribe or leave us a review? We'd love to hear from you. You can follow us on Facebook and by visiting uib.no/antro, where you will also find more information on the ongoing work and upcoming events at the department. Until next time, from our city between the Fjell, take care and ha det bra.